Okay, welcome to the deep dive. So if you've ever looked at blood test results, sometimes they flag something that just seems off, but you feel perfectly okay.
Exactly. And today we're getting into one of those real head scratchers in endocrinology. It's a condition that often just flies under the radar, mainly because, well, the person doesn't have any symptoms.
Right, no symptoms. But, and this is the kicker, it carries this really significant health risk, even death.
It really does. It's what we call subclinical hyperthyroidism, SH for short.
SH. Okay, and that subclinical part, that just means it's not fully obvious, right? Not full-blown symptoms.
Precisely. And that name can be a bit misleading. It makes it sound minor, maybe something you don't need to worry about too much.
Which isn't the case here. But before we get into the risks, maybe a super quick refresher on the thyroid itself. It's key to this whole thing.
Good idea. Yeah, think of your thyroid gland, it's in your neck, as your body's main metabolic control center, like a thermostat or an accelerator.
Regulating energy burn, metabolism speed, that sort of thing.
Exactly. So when we talk SH, subclinical hyperthyroidism, we're looking at a very specific lab pattern. We measure TSH, that's thyroid stimulating hormone. It comes from the pituitary gland in your brain.
That's the message the brain sends down to the thyroid, telling it how active to be.
You got it. So if your thyroid is maybe starting to get a bit overactive, putting out a bit too much hormone, the brain senses that and says, whoa, slow down.
And it turns down the volume on that TSH signal.
Precisely. So in SH, that TSH level is low. The brain's trying to put the brakes on.
Okay.
But, and this is the crucial part, the actual thyroid hormones, T3 and T4, are the ones that control your energy levels. They still measure within the normal range.
Ah, so the output looks okay, even though the control signal is off. And that's why people usually feel fine.
Usually, yes. They don't get those classic hyperthyroid symptoms like racing heart, sweating, tremors. Not usually.
But here's where it gets, frankly, pretty alarming. This quiet imbalance is
Yeah.
definitely not harmless. The research we looked at shows that folks with SH, compared to people with normal thyroid function, that's called euthyroid.
Right, euthyroid is the baseline.
Compared to them, people with SH have a staggering 41% increase in relative all-cause mortality.
41%, it's a huge number. And the data is pretty clear about why. It's not just, feeling a bit unwell. It really zeroes in on two critical systems, your heart and your bones.
Okay, so what specifically?
We see a much higher risk for serious heart rhythm problems, especially atrial fibrillation AFib. That's an irregular heartbeat.
Right, AFib.
And also significant issues with bone density, basically osteoporosis. Your bones get weaker.
Wow. So even though you feel okay, metabolically things seem stable on the surface. That suppressed TSH is already potentially messing with your heart rhythm and leaching calcium from your bones.
That seems to be the mechanism, yes. It's quite insidious.
So our goal today for you listening is to really map this out. How do you know if a low TSH reading is actually SH or something else? When does it just need watching? And what are the specific triggers that mean, okay, time for treatment? All right, let's get into the nuts and bolts then. A patient gets a blood test, TSH comes back low. Now, you can't just leap to assuming it's a thyroid problem, even though that's the big worry, right? What's step one?
Step one is don't panic and recheck. That's the fundamental first principle. A single low reading could be temporary, a blip, or it could be influenced by, gosh, a dozen other things going on in the body.
So rechecking is key. How long do you typically wait?
The standard guidance is usually somewhere between 2 to 4 months. You need to see if that low TSH is persistent.
Okay.
If you recheck and it's back to normal, great. Probably just a temporary fluctuation.
That waiting period makes sense. And during that time, or maybe alongside the recheck, you absolutely have to rule out those other causes, the mimics.
Oh, absolutely critical. This is where good diagnosis happens. If you miss one of these mimics, you might end up treating something that isn't actually subclinical hyperthyroidism at all.
So what are these mimics?
Okay.
What else can cause a low TSH?
We can group them into about four main categories. These are things that can suppress TSH without the thyroid itself being the primary issue.
Okay, category one.
First is systemic illness. We're talking about someone being pretty seriously ill, maybe they're in the hospital, have a major infection, something like that. There's a specific term for it, sick euthyroid syndrome.
Sick euthyroid. Okay, but why would being sick make your TSH go down? Wouldn't your body need more energy, sort of rev up?
You'd think so, but it's actually the opposite. When the body is under severe stress from illness, it goes into conservation mode. It's trying to save energy, not spend it. So it dials down the metabolic rate.
A protective shutdown almost.
Kind of, yeah. And part of that involves temporarily suppressing the TSH signal. So you get this low reading, but the thyroid itself might be perfectly healthy underneath it all.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, mimic number two. This one seems a bit more straightforward. Pregnancy.
Yes. During pregnancy, especially the first trimester, the hormone HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin.
The main pregnancy hormone.
All right, its structure is actually a bit similar to TSH, and it can directly stimulate the thyroid gland a little bit.
So the thyroid gets stimulated by HCG. The brain sees enough thyroid hormone and it lowers the TSH signal.
Exactly. It's a natural expected change during pregnancy. So interpreting TSH levels then requires knowing those pregnancy-specific norms.
Got it. Okay, category three. This takes us sort of upstream to the control system in the brain.
Right. We need to consider pituitary or hypothalamic insufficiency.
So the problem isn't the thyroid, it's the glands telling the thyroid what to do. The pituitary isn't sending out enough TSH to begin with.
Precisely. It's a top-down failure. Now, the key clue here is really important because it actually breaks the definition of SH. If you suspect a pituitary problem is causing the low TSH, you often look at the T4 and T3 levels.
Which are supposed to be normal in SH.
Exactly. But in pituitary insufficiency, those T4 and T3 levels might actually be on the low side of normal, or even frankly low. That suggests the whole system is underactive, not just a suppressed TSH signal reacting to an overactive thyroid.
Okay, that's a critical distinction. And the final mimic, category four. This one seems like it could be easy to miss if you're not careful. Medications.
Definitely. Certain drugs can directly mess with that brain-thyroid communication.
Which ones are the main culprits?
The big ones mentioned are thyroxine itself, which is, ironically, the medication used to treat low thyroid function, hypothyroidism.
So if the dose is too high, it suppresses TSH.
Correct. And the other major group is steroids, glucocorticoids, things like prednisone. They can also push TSH down.
So just reviewing someone's medication list could potentially solve the mystery right there.
Absolutely. Sometimes it's that simple. It's not a thyroid disorder, it's a medication effect.
Okay, that rundown of the mimics really shows why you need that careful initial workup, the recheck, the history, ruling things out. But let's move forward. Let's say the TSH stays low after the recheck, and you have ruled out those mimics. No severe illness, not pregnant, pituitary seems okay, no interfering meds. Now you're looking at confirmed, persistent, subclinical hyperthyroidism. The patient probably still feels fine.
Right.
So here's the million-dollar question. When do you shift from just monitoring to actually intervening, starting
This,
treatment?
yeah, this is the crucial decision point. And you have to balance the fact that it's subclinical against that, pretty stark 41% mortality risk increase we talked about.
You can't just ignore it forever.
No, you can't. But you also don't necessarily treat every single person with a slightly low TSH, especially if they have zero symptoms. For those individuals, if the TSH is low but not severely low, and they feel fine, the approach is often watchful waiting, close monitoring.
How close?
Typically checkups every 6 months or so, keep an eye on their TSH, maybe periodically check their heart rhythm, bone density scans down the line.
Right. Okay, watchful waiting. But there must be a threshold, a point where monitoring isn't enough.
There is, and it's defined by a specific TSH level. This is the number everyone needs to remember. Treatment is strongly considered when the TSH is persistently less than 0.1.
Less than 0.1, so
Yeah.
really, really suppressed, barely detectable.
Exactly. That level indicates a more significant degree of underlying thyroid overactivity, even if T3 and T4 are still hanging out in the normal range.
But is TSH 0.1 enough on its own? Does everyone below that level automatically get treatment?
Not necessarily automatically, but it's the major trigger. However, the guidelines usually recommend treatment when that very low TSH is combined with at least one other specific risk factor or finding.
Ah, okay, so it's TSH less than 0.1 plus something else from a checklist.
Exactly. It's about identifying those individuals where the subclinical state is already showing signs of causing harm or is highly likely to. There's a list of five key factors.
Okay, let's go through that checklist. What are the five things that, when paired with TSH 0.1, push you towards treatment?
Okay, number one, if the patient starts developing even subtle symptoms suggestive of hyperthyroidism, maybe some unexplained anxiety, maybe mild palpitations, maybe heat intolerance they didn't have before.
So the subclinical is maybe becoming a little bit clinical.
Sort of, yes. Even if T3, T4 are technically normal, the body might be starting to feel it. Number two, confirming that major cardiac risk we mentioned. So the presence of atrial fibrillation.
AFib.
If AFib shows up, that's a clear sign the heart's affected. Treatment needed.
Absolutely. Urgent indication, really. Mm-hmm. Third, any significant documented unexplained weight loss.
Right.
If they're losing weight without trying, that suggests the metabolism is inappropriately revved up.
Right. Connects back to that accelerator idea. What's number four?
Number four is confirming the skeletal risk, evidence of osteoporosis. If a bone density scan shows weak bones, that TSH suppression is likely contributing.
So you treat to protect the bones from getting worse.
Precisely. And finally, number five, the presence of a goiter.
Which is an enlarged thyroid gland. You might see or feel a swelling in the neck. A goiter often signals there's an underlying issue with the thyroid gland itself, like nodules that could be causing the overactivity.
Okay, so to recap that trigger point, TSH persistently less than 0.1, plus any one of those five subtle symptoms, AFib, unexplained weight loss, osteoporosis, or a goiter. If you hit that combination, treatment's generally recommended.
That's the threshold, yes, to mitigate those serious long-term risks.
And what are the treatment options mentioned? What do doctors actually do?
The goal is to reduce the thyroid's hormone production. The source material points to two main strategies. One is medication using anti-thyroid drugs. The name Carbaly is mentioned, which usually refers to drugs like carbinazole or its active form, methimazole. These block hormone production.
Okay, pills. And the other option?
The other is radioiodine therapy. This uses a small targeted dose of radioactive iodine, which the thyroid gland absorbs. It then gently damages or destroys some of the overactive thyroid cells.
A more permanent solution, potentially.
Often, yes. It aims to permanently reduce the thyroid capacity. The choice between drugs and radioiodine depends on various patient factors.
Right. So let's bring this all together. Mm-hmm. For you, the listener, what's the absolute core message here? I think it has to be understanding that paradox. Subclinical sounds minor, asymptomatic sounds harmless, but in this case, it's definitely not.
Absolutely.
You need to remember that specific lab pattern, low TSH, but normal T3 and T4. And crucially, remember that it carries that very real 41% increased risk of mortality, mainly from those heart and bone problems.
Yeah, and thinking bigger picture, this whole condition is such a great example of why differential diagnosis is so key in medicine. You see a lab result like a low TSH, but that's just data. The critical thinking comes in confirming why it's low.
Making sure it isn't just, you know, being sick or pregnant or a medication side effect.
Exactly. Ruling out those mimics, those four categories we discussed, is just as important as knowing when and how to treat the actual condition. You have to be sure what you're dealing with.
Definitely. The nuance matters hugely here, which leads us to maybe a final point to think about. It's pretty fascinating, isn't it? How the body's main control signal, TSH, can be so suppressed enough to raise mortality risk by 41%, yet the actual circulating hormones, T3 and T4, somehow manage to stay within the normal lab range.
It really is. It speaks volumes about regulatory systems and maybe how different tissues respond differently.
Yeah, it's like the body's overall structure, the bones, and the heart's electrical rhythm are somehow more sensitive to that low TSH signal than our general feeling of well-being is.
They're acting almost like an early warning system, even if we don't feel the warning ourselves.
Exactly. The bones and the heart rhythm become the canaries in the coal mine for this otherwise silent threat, something definitely worth pondering.